Those of you who don't know me, I'm Martha Crenshaw. I'm a senior fellow at CSAC and FSI. And it's with a great deal of pleasure that I'm here to introduce Rachel Gillum. Many of you know Rachel already because she's a pre-doctoral fellow here at CSAC this year. She's a PhD candidate in the political science department here at Stanford. I have the great fortune to serve on her committee. And she also was my research assistant for a major project funded by the DoD Minerva Initiative and the National Science Foundation on mapping militant organizations. She really was the sort of glue who held the project together. Her talk is going to focus on her analysis of Muslim American attitudes and trust in government. She's done a very rare thing of doing a survey of 500 Muslims as well as a number of other non-Muslims, including a set of Latinos using YouGov. And it's still amazing to me how little attention we've paid to the Muslim minority in the United States. So Rachel has filled a very large gap. And we're also very fortunate to have as our discussant Shireen Sinar from the Stanford Law School, whom some of you also know because she comes to Stanford CSAC events and has over the years. She's an assistant professor of law at Stanford, where she also got her JD, and she's worked a lot with public interest law firms in San Francisco and elsewhere, and has worked on issues of discrimination. And I think you teach a class on terrorism in the law, so obviously we have compatible interests. So I'm sure all of you know the drill, which is that Rachel will speak for 30, 35 minutes or so. We'll then turn the floor over to Shireen for some comments, and then we will open it up for questions and answers. And I will, as usual, keep a list. If I don't see you, just keep waving at me. I will try to look around and eventually I will see you. So with that, let me turn the floor over to Rachel. Rachel, with no further ado. And welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Martha. As Martha mentioned, today I'm going to be presenting a chapter from my dissertation. If you have any clarifying questions along the way, please feel free to stop me, but if we could save more substantive questions for the end, that would be great. So my broader dissertation looks at the political attitudes and behaviors of Muslim Americans. Today I want to hone in on a chapter that looks at attitudes towards a particular government institution, one that that Muslims have unfortunately been associated with in the post-9/11 environment, and that is of U.S. law enforcement. Now, we know that attitudes towards U.S. law enforcement are important because they tend to shape attitudes towards the overall government. And we know that attitudes and beliefs of government legitimacy are important because it tends to determine whether individuals are willing to comply with government laws, and in the case of law enforcement, perhaps assist law enforcement investigations. First, I want to start by just giving you a little context of the Muslim American experience in the post-9/11 environment. Many of you remember the Times Square bombing attempt. Faisal Shahzad, Pakistani-American, attempted to detonate a bomb in the middle of Times Square. Two passerbyers, one a Muslim, saw suspicious activity and reported it to police immediately. Now, this was seen the NYPD was able to go and detonate the bomb without any casualties. This was seen as a major failure on the part of law enforcement to detect an attack in advance, but is seen as a major victory and a great example of Muslim Americans cooperating with law enforcement and counterterrorism policing. And in fact, just months later, and throughout that time, NYPD Police Commissioner Ray Kelly was going throughout New York to local mosques, visiting and praising the act of this Muslim passerby for his assistance with law enforcement. He was quoted at a local Queens mosque saying, "This man, a Muslim, he saw something, he said something," and he was encouraging the other congregants to continue to cooperate and assist police in this way. He was also quoted saying that the NYPD does not and cannot engage in any type of religious or ethnic profiling. But it was uncovered just a little over a year later that the very mosque he was speaking at was itself under surveillance and had informants inserted in the mosque. As you can imagine, the imam and other leaders were very much frustrated at this, given they had reached out and voluntarily cooperated with the NYPD and the federal government. But they were not alone. Under this unprecedented alliance between the NYPD and the CIA, hundreds of mosques and student organizations were placed under surveillance. Entire mosques were able to be labeled as terrorist organizations, opening up any individual who attended prayer or affiliated with the mosque, open up to surveillance. As you can see here, undercover teams were sent out to map out entire neighborhoods based on ethnic affiliation, laying out places of interest where people ate, sleep, tongue out, and often with no affiliation with criminal activity. This is an example of a neighborhood in Brooklyn of Egyptian areas of interest. The NYPD even went beyond the borders of New York into New Jersey and did similar mapping in other neighborhoods there as well. This is an example here of a house of a Nigerian family where they at times hosted prayer. As you can imagine, again, this was very upsetting. This is a big national headline considering the secrecy of the program. President Obama's chief counterterrorism advisor at the time, John Brennan, was sent out to do some damage control with the Muslim constituents, those who had been cooperating with the government in counterterrorism policing. I was able to sit down in this meeting with John Brennan and several like it, which gave me some good insight to sort of some of the frustrations and feelings and discussions that were happening amongst Muslim American leaders at this time. The African-American imam who was hosting this meeting, this in particular meeting, likened the treatment of Muslims in the United States to that of African-Americans, particularly in the 1960s, citing infiltration, treatment of these individuals as something other than American citizens. Another civil rights attorney emphasized that the treatment of Muslims not only emphasized the Muslim American community, but to the broader American community, that Muslims are indeed criminals and not deserving of equal rights and treatment. Despite John Brennan's efforts, many of these Muslims that day went on to sue the United States government. Some Muslim American organizations spoke and asked, encouraged Muslims to no longer go to police if they had concerns about terrorism. And others asked that those who are currently cooperating with law enforcement to consider changing their mind. But of course, during the course of my research, I talked to many Muslims around the United States, several other roundtables and one-on-one conversations. And there was a diverse set of views towards law enforcement. Some said, you know, while there is the occasional corruption, I don't think law enforcement conspires against any particular group. Others thought it was sort of a necessary evil to single out some Muslims. I respect what the FBI is doing. It's responsible for keeping our country safe, and I can trust them to do what is right most of the time. Others went so far as to say that it's Muslims' own fault that they're being singled out due to their behavior, the way they dress, things like that, encouraging other Muslims to assimilate and leave their cultural customs behind. So again, this is a diverse set of views, different perspectives from people all over the country. And provided that all these individuals have such diverse views in the same post-9/11 environment, it caused me to ask, what are the factors contributing towards various attitudes towards U.S. law enforcement? How are these attitudes shaped? So to answer this question, as I mentioned, I did extensive in-depth interviewing. I sat in on several roundtables, like the one with John Brennan and other U.S. government leaders that have liaisons to the Muslim American community. But more commonly, I sat in on roundtables with various imams and Islamic political leaders, as well as had one-on-one conversations with Muslims from a variety of ethnic groups. But to ensure that I was getting a nationally representative glimpse and a systematic glimpse of how Muslim American attitudes are formed, I ran an original nationwide survey to Muslim Americans across the United States. The survey touched on a variety of attitudes towards government, but in particular I'm going to focus on a between subjects randomized survey today. It allows me to assess different attitudes and expectations that are brought up when the police are engaging with a Muslim suspect and how that differs from when police are engaging with a non-Muslim suspect. Just to give you a preview of some of the things that I find, first, I find it is significant that the majority of Muslims are born overseas. I find that individuals' experiences in their home country are brought with them to some degree into the United States. Specifically, I find that those who lived under corrupt institutions, had an experience of poor governance, brought with them negative expectations for poor governance to the United States. I find, however, that these effects seem to have faded by the time individuals have naturalized. And then finally, I find that greater socialization of the United States typically leads to more pessimistic views of U.S. law enforcement. Specifically, I find that those who are born and raised in the United States are particularly cynical and are particularly sensitive to the treatment of Muslims in the United States. And I'll get into these all in more detail in just a moment. But first, why are we talking about fairness, and what do we know about what determines how individuals view the fairness of law enforcement? Well, it's the procedural justice literature that really hones in on this idea that it's really the interaction one has with law enforcement that is thought to determine overall judgments. So the classic example is imagine you're pulled over for a speeding ticket. Literature argues that your judgment of the police will be determined not based on whether you receive a ticket, but whether that interaction was conducted objectively and fairly with respect to you being treated as an equal member of society. But of course, we know that individuals can interpret identical events very differently based on a variety of features. We see in research that, in particular, the identity of the suspect tends to affect how individuals view the legitimacy of police or government behavior. For instance, we see in a variety of studies that Black respondents tend to be more suspicious of police interactions with Black suspects relative to white respondents, whereas white respondents will, and this is largely because they expect the Black suspect to be treated less fairly than the white, whereas white respondents will expect police to treat Black and white suspects equally fair. Now, these diverging views are thought to come out of nowhere, but are thought to be formed based on past experiences individuals have had or group common knowledge based on in-group identity. So today I want to argue that there are some particular features of Muslims' backgrounds that we should take into consideration in an attempt to fully understand how attitudes are formed. In particular, I'm going to focus on immigrant status, whether one was born and raised in the United States in the same school system, social systems, or whether they're born overseas, and where they were born, under what institutions were they governed, what was their experience with government there. And then finally, racial minority status. We know that race has important implications for a variety of social political outcomes, and I want to take that into account as well. So quickly, I want to address sort of what we know about how attitudes are formed, particularly among immigrant groups. So on the one hand, it's not entirely clear on what individuals, how attitudes are formed among those who have relatively less experience with the United States government. But what we do know is that the institutions under which ones are governed tend to shape attitudes towards government. Specifically, we find over and over again that experiences living under corruption are thought to suppress any positive attitudes towards government. It lessens trust in government. And we know that these types of attitudes tend to be sticky over time. They're often talked about as even cultural traits, this type of trust in government. So on the one hand, I do expect that that immigrants, coming from more corrupt governments will have less lower expectations of police overall compared to those coming from less corrupt countries. But of course, we know that as individuals have more interactions in the United States, as they have more interactions with people here, we might expect these attitudes and beliefs to change over time. In particular, naturalization represents, for some, a disassociation with the home country and more of an association with where they're living currently. So in particular, we might expect that home frame of references will fade as individuals have increasing interactions. They will update their beliefs. So I expect that those who have naturalized in the United States will show less home country effects than those who are newcomers to the U.S. So even if we expect the individual bring with them experiences from their home country, but those will then fade over time, we have to consider how are Muslims updating in the United States? What are they learning about law enforcement and how they're treated? So earlier chapters of my dissertation demonstrate that Muslims are very aware of mistreatment of some Muslims in the United States by law enforcement. And we know that these sort of perceptions tend to create a sense of group consciousness or views of in-group and out-group, us versus them, these types of feelings. We also know that groups that receive more discrimination tend to be less trusting of the government. But again, we know less in political science about how attitudes among immigrants are formed. But what we do know that indeed, on the one hand, as immigrants have increasing interactions with law enforcement, we find, at least among Asian immigrants, that these individuals tend to have less trust in police. So, again, increasing number of interactions, whether that be police or whether that even be immigration officials, these have the same effect. However, at the same time, we find that among Hispanics, that immigrants tend to perceive relatively less group-based discrimination in the United States, and that's thought to be because they are less aware of the stereotypes and U.S. history of group-based discrimination. So while more time in the United States might suppress feelings towards the overall system, it's not clear that immigrants will perceive this group-based difference. But we find that by the time we see second and third generations, that these individuals are very aware of group-based differences in the United States because they are more familiar with the system and have higher expectations of equality and justice in the United States. So based on this, I would expect that as individuals become more familiar with the American system, their overall trust in police will go down, particularly in the treatment towards Muslims. So specifically, I expect that naturalized citizens will expect less fair treatment of police than non-citizens, and that U.S. foreign respondents will expect less fair treatment by police, especially towards Muslim suspects and those who are born overseas. And finally, as a final point, Muslims are the most racially diverse religious group in the United States. And again, we know that race has important implications for a variety of political and social outcomes. So again, we must take this into account. In regards to law enforcement, we know that racial minorities are the most likely to be a victim of police violence and profiling in the United States. We might expect that Muslims who are also racial minorities might have had more interactions with police in this regard. And specifically, these types of interactions tend to cause individuals to perceive that they're being targeted because of their race, because they're minorities. And as a result, we see in various studies that minorities tend to be less trusting of police, view the government as less legitimate, and are less willing to cooperate with law enforcement. And again, in earlier chapters of my dissertation, I do find that Muslims who identify as racial minorities are more sensitive to the treatment of Muslims. They are more sensitive to religious discrimination in the United States. So as an extension of the previous two hypotheses, I also expect that individuals who identify as racial minorities will also be less positive expectations of police in the United States. So, okay, enough with the political science, but so how did I do this? So most studies looking at Muslims in the United States largely focus on regional groups. This is largely because the Muslim American community is very small in the United States, less than 1%, estimated to be about 0.6% of the U.S. population. The Muslim American community is expected to grow, in fact, double in the next 20 years, and there's expected to be more Muslims in the United States than any European country other than Russia. So in order to get, again, a national glimpse of Muslims in the United States, I conducted an online survey that was nationally representative of Muslims through the International Polling Forum, YouGov. Just got this data back a few months ago, achieved over 500 respondents. We had good dispersion, covered 45 states plus Washington, D.C. Among those who were born overseas, captured individuals from 46 different nations. And we weighted the responses based on Pew Research Center's estimates of the Muslim population, which is thought to be the best estimate of what the Muslim American community looks like. In addition to the survey, as I mentioned, I conducted several in-depth interviews as well. Again, many larger roundtables, group discussions, but also one-on-one conversations, phone interviews, as well as a variety of open-form questionnaires. It was very interesting talking to a variety of groups. Much of the Muslim American community is divided up by ethnic groups, and so many different conversations, but some also had, mixed organizations as well. So today I'm going to talk mostly about the survey, but I'm happy to talk more about the interviews and what I learned there. So as far as what I'm considering when I'm looking at the attitudes, I'm looking at a variety of features that respondents answered in my survey. I allowed individuals to self-identify in a variety of racial and ethnic categories of their choice, as many as they wanted, and I'll talk about that in a moment. I also looked at generational status, whether one was born in the United States or abroad. As far as measuring the familiarity with the U.S. system, among those born abroad, I used the measure of naturalization, whether one is a naturalized citizen or not. And then in looking at the country of origin features, I look at the level of corruption in the country from which they came, institutional corruption. So this is a layout of my sample based on generation and race. So here, again, it's a very diverse group. Most people, when they think of the Muslim American community, tend to think of Arabs, but Arabs are by no means the majority of the population. They are thought to be the best politically mobile, best well-integrated in some senses, largely because Muslim Arabs follow their Christian predecessors to the United States and were welcomed with, again, established institutions. They have shared language, again, which is thought to accommodate a lot of political mobilization. This white category is somewhat misleading on its surface. Again, I allow people to identify racially, but also ethnically, and I also ask them what country they were born in and what country their parents were born in. So among these U.S.-born whites, about half of these individuals report being converts and third generation or more American. The other half are individuals, although they identify as white only, say that their parents were born in Arab countries in Turkey or Eastern Europe. Among foreign-born whites, these are, again, although they identify as white only, are individuals born in either Arab countries, Turkey, or Eastern Europe as well. We see that black Muslims make up a large portion of the U.S. foreign population. Most people, when they think of black Muslims, tend to think of the Nation of Islam. What most people don't know is that the Nation of Islam was dissolved in 1976, and the majority of black Muslims were brought into mainstream Sunni Islam by then-leader W.D. Muhammad. The Nation of Islam, of course, still exists today. It was resurrected by Louis Farrakhan, although it is much, much smaller than it was at its height during the Civil Rights Movement. And about a third of my black U.S. Muslims identify with the Nation of Islam. And as far as blacks born overseas, these are individuals largely from Africa and some from the Caribbean. As for Asian respondents, these are largely individuals born in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, so on and so forth, and then others, a few individuals who identified as more than one race, which is very few, but also Persians. Persians also fall into the Asian category and white category as well. There's not a clear pattern with how they identify racially. Again, I look at the level of corruption from which the country in which individuals come. So here I'm using the control of corruption measure from the World Bank's political indicators. I also rerun this with other measures of corruption, including Transparency International, for those of you concerned. But here on the y-axis, I have a list of countries in which all my respondents were born. On the x-axis here is the control of corruption index that goes from -2 to +2, higher numbers meaning better control of corruption. At the top here, we have the Netherlands, Australia, and Canada. Then all the way down at the lowest level, basically highest level of corruption, we have Nigeria, Bangladesh, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Somalia.
Where's the United States? The
United States is up here, so it's about fifth down, so towards the better control of corruption relative. And these numbers are averages across 4 years for more reliable estimates, but these numbers don't tend to change a lot from year to year. And just to get a view of the distribution, where are our Muslim immigrants coming from, we see the bulk of these individuals are coming from countries with higher levels of corruption, so below zero here. So here in this chapter, I really want to look at how attitudes are formed towards law enforcement, again, depending on whether the suspect is a Muslim or a non-Muslim. So here I use an item that just sort of sets up a general base case for individuals to assess. I give them very little information here. All they know is that there's a young man, 23 years old, he's an American citizen. He has no criminal record, but there's been an anonymous tip that he's getting ready to commit a major crime. So here, the only thing I randomize or change about this individual is his identity. So Umar Saeed, presumably a Muslim, or Jake Lewis, presumably a non-Muslim. So after answering a variety of questions, individuals are then asked, generally speaking, do you think the U.S. law enforcement will treat a person like this fairly? Individuals answer on a 7-point scale from completely agree to completely disagree. And randomization was successful on this item for those who are concerned. But again, this is my main outcome variable of interest here. Looking at, again, expectations of fairness, how the police will treat this individual, again, in an identical situation. So I'm getting ready to show you two sets of analyses. The first is going to look at foreign-born Muslims only, and I'm going to be focusing in on the effect of home country corruption and whether that effect changes based on whether individuals are citizens or not. Then I'm going to move and show you the entire sample and make some generational comparisons and look at the effect of race as well. All the outcomes you see are results from OLS regression with standard controls, age, income, education, and gender with robust standard errors. So recall, I'm expecting that experiences living under countries with high levels of corruption will suppress trust in government, as will familiarity with the U.S. system, which I'm measuring with individuals being naturalized. Based on the literature, it's not clear that those who are born overseas should be particularly aware of group-based discrimination, but I control for this as well. So these are coefficient plots. So we see that although corruption and naturalization do have an overall negative effect on trust, these are not statistically distinguishable from zero, nor is the treatment effect here. But recall that we expect that home country effects will be dependent on, again, how familiar one is with the United States, whether they're a citizen or not. So once I include this interaction term, we see that it is statistically significant. And to just give you an idea of sort of what this looks like, a visualization, I map it out here. On the y-axis, we have predicted values of expected fairness. On the x-axis, levels of corruption moving from low to high levels of corruption, country of origin. So first, this black line here, these are non-citizens. So we see that moving from individuals who are coming from countries with low levels of corruption, they have relatively higher levels of trust or higher expectations for fairness than those coming from more corrupt countries. We see that expectations for fairness decline as we move from more corrupt places. This blue line here, these are citizens. So basically we see that moving from non-citizen to citizen, we see that any benefit from coming from a non-corrupt country seems to have been lost by the time individuals have naturalized. This line is essentially flat. It does slope down slightly, but it's essentially flat. We see that, again, by the time individuals have naturalized, they sort of set a standard level of expectations for fairness here. For completeness, I examine whether naturalized citizens are more likely to come to, you know, Umar or the Muslim suspect, or if whether those from more corrupt countries are more sensitive to the Muslim suspect. It doesn't seem to be the case. But again, we still see the strong effect of the interaction term here. So now I move to the full sample. Now we're looking at both foreign-born and U.S.-born Muslims. What I'm going to show you here is the expected value of fairness, predicted value of fairness based on whether the suspect is Jake or Umar. And then on the right-hand side, I show just the treatment effect, the difference in expected fairness between the two suspects. So first we have the main effect. So overall, in looking at the entire sample, we see that Muslims generally expect the Muslim suspect to be treated less fairly than the non-Muslim suspect. It's a statistically significant difference, a 13 percentage point drop. However, though, when we look at generation, we see a slightly different story. As we saw in the previous assessment, foreign-born Muslims are not really distinguishing between the treatment of the Muslim suspect and the non-Muslim suspect. In fact, they expect basically these individuals to be treated identically in the same situation. Moving down, looking at the baseline condition of Jake, U.S.-born and foreign-born Muslims actually expect similar things from the police in this condition. But it's when we move from Jake to Umar that we see the significant drop in expected fairness, a 20-point percentage drop, and this is also statistically significant. And recall that I was expecting that individuals who identified as racial minorities will be more sensitive to the treatment of Muslims. We don't quite see this entirely here. Looking first Arabs and Asians and all these groups, there's a slight drop in expectations of fairness. However, the only group that dropped significantly is that of African-American Muslims. This isn't entirely surprising, provided that a variety of studies have shown that blacks tend to be more cynical of police. But again, not quite what I expected here. But also recall that a good portion of the U.S.-born Muslim population do identify as black. So it could also be that, you know, this big drop from blacks is really what's driving this effect among U.S.-born Muslims. So to ensure that this generational effect is not in terms of black effect, I do interactions with a generation race. But you have to be careful because these bins get increasingly small as we chop up the data, but it'll give us an idea, as to whether this is a generational effect or something different among blacks. So here we have generational effects by race. So first looking at Arabs, we see the same pattern. We see that foreign-born Muslims don't significantly distinguish between the two suspects, but those Arabs born in the United States see a significant drop in expected fairness moving from Jake to Umar. Blacks, again, we see a major drop among U.S.-born moving from Jake to Umar here. We also see a drop among U.S.-born whites. However, it just barely misses statistical significance. The really only exception here is among Asians. We see both groups drop, but not significantly. So this is something that I'll have to dig more into to see why this generational effect didn't seem to appear among individuals identifying as Asian. And again, just for those of you wondering, I do actually conduct the same experiment with a nationally representative group of Latinos and also of just a nationally representative sample of Americans to provide a baseline. So if anyone's interested in sort of how Muslims compare to other groups, I'm happy to show that as well. But these are the main results of this paper. So overall, we do see that Muslims tend to expect less fair treatment of Muslims systematically in identical situations compared to how non-Muslim suspects are treated. But really, we find that this effect is driven by those who are born and raised in the United States. Otherwise, foreign-born Muslims, although they vary in how they view the system overall, depending on where they came from, they do not seem to identify a difference between how Muslims and non-Muslims are treated overall. But again, it seems that foreign-born Muslims, their views of the government are, in fact, determined in part by their experiences in their country of origin. But these seem to have faded by the time individuals have naturalized. So there's a variety of implications for what we found here. On the one hand, it is very interesting that home country effects can travel over from one country to the next. We can imagine that this might have implications for a variety of political and social outcomes, which I intend to investigate further on in future studies. Also, we see here that future studies that are assessing attitudes toward the government should really specify the subject of government treatment. Because on the one hand, we saw that U.S.-born and foreign-born Muslims had the same expectations of police considered in the baseline condition, that is, when the suspect was a non-Muslim. But really, we saw the drop in trust among U.S.-born Muslims when we're specifying that the suspect was also a Muslim. And that is different than what we've seen in other studies looking at Hispanics. And finally, we see some evidence of a pan-Muslim identity, but really this seems to be among those born in the United States, seeing Muslims as a broader group with which they identify and are sensitive to the treatment of. And there's a variety of policy implications to this study, but just to mention a few, this observation that Muslims are becoming more cynical over successive generations could mean one or two things. On the one hand, it could mean that Muslims becoming like other Americans. Americans tend to be very cynical of the government, very critical, and very outspoken about policies that people don't like. On the other hand, provided that we see really the drop in trust when talking about the treatment of Muslims, this may also be a sign of a sense of alienation in future generations as they become more aware of the different treatment of Muslims and non-Muslims. And then finally, in the next chapter of my dissertation, I show that these attitudes of fairness do matter for a variety of outcomes, but they determine whether individuals are willing to cooperate with law enforcement and counterterrorism policing. And just to give you a quick glimpse of the other topics I touch in my dissertation, I do look at how racial identification and desires for integration are formed among Muslims. Today we talked about attitudes towards law enforcement. The next chapter, again, looks at when individuals are willing to cooperate, voluntarily assist law enforcement. The fifth looks at attitudes towards political violence, and I do a survey among Muslims as well as non-Muslims and show that patterns of support for violence are actually identical between the two groups. And then finally, I do a case study of looking at the experience of Somali Americans in the United States. So thank you so much. I look forward to your questions.